everyone. I'm Natasha Ryan, host of Time to Head North, the North Group's podcast. And today I have the privilege of having my friend Patrick Kane on. Patrick is a well-known corporate security professional throughout our industry and within all of the industry groups. Thank you so much for your time and joining me today, Patrick.
Well, it's an honor, actually, Natasha. Thank you very much. I'm happy to be on.
So for the viewers that don't have the privilege of knowing you, just give a little bit about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. So I work in the corporate space. I've been in the private sector for about 25 years. Before that, I was a Marine Corps infantry officer for a short time. In the private sector, I focus heavily on managing overseas security operations and travel risk.
And I love this whole idea of talking about travel risk management within the industry groups, right? So you are involved in ASIS, as I have been in the past, and all of these industry organizations play such a pivotal role for professional development, collaboration, networking, all the things, right? So I want to talk first and foremost about this travel risk management working group, and you actually helped found it. So I want to hear how this all came about.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I give a lot of the credit actually to Kevin Coffey. He's a retired LAPD officer who's been working as an independent consultant in that space for about 20 years. And he and I are friends, and we're also kind of neighbors. We're in the same area in Southern California generally. So we hook up periodically for coffee and things like that. And we were having some conversations around the absence of opportunities to speak about this topic in professional groups. And he had asked me initially about OSAC, if OSAC would want to do like a common interest council on travel security and travel risk. And I kind of told him, I said, well, OSAC is kind of about that. I mean, anyway, right, that's a heavy focus of their organization. And we started talking about ASIS, and he mentioned that ASIS, in the past anyway, hadn't had much interest in starting this up. But we decided we'd have a shot at it again, and we submitted an application to start a community oriented on travel risk management. And I think one of the things that helped us a lot was the introduction of the ISO 31030 standard a couple of years ago, because it created something that was kind of a benchmark for people to follow. And I think it kind of elevated the focus on the topic within the industry. So ASIS International actually responded pretty quickly to our request to start the group. So we started up about a year ago, actually. It was about April or May of 2023 we got started. And we've got about 350 members or so all throughout the world who are involved in it. Some of them are people who are involved in OSAC and some are not. So it's helpful to us because we're capturing a population that we wouldn't always interact with in OSAC events, as an example. And as a result, receiving perspectives from other areas that we otherwise would not probably. So since its inception, we've done, I think, a single webinar, and we've done three in-person events. So we did our first in-person event in San Diego in October of 2023. We did one in New York City in October 23. And we just had one here in the LA area in Santa Monica in February of 24. And this has provided us an opportunity to have a lot of in-person conversations. We've done a variety of separate types of I guess, kind of modes or modalities for it. So we've done static presentation, you know, like what you would ordinarily get at a conference.
Yeah.
We've done things that were more kind of roundtable interactive, where you cycled in between individual roundtables, which were topic-based, and had conversations with peers at those roundtables. And then our event in Santa Monica in February, we did a combination of both. We started with some static type presentations, and then we kind of moved on to topic oriented roundtables.
So one of the questions, you know, out of the gate, obviously, I have is, you mentioned there is a standard that you guys adhere to within this group, kind of as your guideline. And this has been a hot topic inside the industry organization around other subject matters. But I mean, how important is it to have that standard so everyone's on the same page and you have that jumping off space?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not, generally speaking, a big fan of those standards, which are kind of more on the prescriptive type, because you tend to have a handful of individuals who have experience perhaps, but they have the experience that they have, deciding what everyone else will do. And a lot of times it ends up not working out too well. The ISO 31030, which actually it comes from ISO, which is the International Standards Organization. It's a global standard, and but it's actually, I think it even says on the cover, it's not really technically a standard, it's more a guideline. And I think the power is in the fact that it is actually open to flexibility around the organization. And it even starts off where it talks about that the things within the guideline have to be tailored to the particular culture of the organization, to the operations of the organization, and so forth. Because if you were to have something oriented like this, a travel risk, and you would really have a hard time applying something that would work for international aid organizations or faith-based groups, and also work for financial institutions and airlines and a variety of other things. So it allows the flexibility to be kind of modified within the organization's particular footprint and culture, while at the same time providing a kind of a benchmarking document that you're able to kind of look at and say, well, are we doing this? Are we doing that? What areas are there that we can improve upon and strengthen?
You brought up one of my favorite topics in your answer. So we preach. You can't go into an organization when you're talking about any facet of security and expect them to adapt to you, right? You have to go into a culture respecting their culture and then adapt to them with your security practices. So let's play the what could go wrong scenario, or what have you seen go wrong when you've seen organizations, especially around travel risk, go in and try to like put the hammer down on executives traveling or a travel risk program and not respecting the culture. Like, what could go wrong? What has gone wrong?
Well, I think generally speaking, if you go against the culture, even if the upper management sometimes of an organization moves contrary to the organization's culture, they just aren't complying. I mean, and this becomes a problem because you can go and have a variety of procedures in place, but if people don't follow them throughout the organization, then it's unhelpful, really. One of the things I've seen a lot that I think is problematic as I speak to people at other organizations is more of a what I would call a tick box approach. So there's a feeling that, well, I need to have this and this and this and this, so I'll get a subscription with assistance provider A, and I'll do this and I'll do that, and then I'll kind of put it on a shelf, and it sort of is not my problem. And you know, for some organizations that have very benign travel patterns, that may work, but I don't think it's ideal. I think you need to be able to really understand the areas where your travelers are going, the type of things that they're doing, and things of that nature, and craft a program that's going to go and facilitate the travel, enable business, and keep them safe at the same time.
What do you do? And I know that we have a lot of seasoned professionals listening, but for someone that's, you know, that is kind of new even to, let's say, the EP realm, right? And has to be part of a travel risk plan and protecting, you know, executives overseas or while they travel, even domestically. What do you do when your principal is non-compliant? Like, how do you handle that when an executive doesn't want to have people around them, but it's necessary for the safety is asking?
Yeah, I think my answer is kind of two-part, and I'm sure my colleagues in the EP world have seen this as well too, although EP can be slightly different because some cases you may have like board mandates and other things which are driving it. But I think one of the things is that you want to educate first. You want to educate constructively, and you want to try and create a program that is not intrusive. So again, to looking at the EP example, you know, we've seen over a period of time that there's a lot of models for EP that can be where it's not so intrusive on the principal, where it's not necessarily like surrounding them with a formation or a phalanx of people, but there are other ways which are more subtle with protective intelligence and things of that nature that can facilitate programs of that type for a principal who has concerns. And I think it's the same thing in a way for a senior executive for travel. You can present them with education about the importance of it and the impact for them, for their safety, and also for the impact of the organization if something happens with them when they're traveling. And then present it in a way where you're facilitating their travel. So, for example, if you have a an executive or a senior person in your organization who travels to the same area all the time, feels very comfortable there and things like that, and they're like, oh, I'll take a taxi from the airport. If you can offer them a good quality provider in terms of transportation, you can offer them something that's actually an upgrade from what they normally do. And sometimes if you couch it in terms of improving their efficiency, as you would perhaps with an EP situation, you're offering them a kind of a benefit and still accomplishing what you have to do on the security side as well. I do think, though, when talking about travel risk in particular, at some point you can educate, you can make all the resources available, but you may have people who don't comply, and that's just it kind of is what it is. I think for the managers and people who own these programs at their organizations, they can't hold every traveler's hand. And I was speaking with somebody the other day. She's got 80,000 travelers. So for her to manage that is hard on a kind of good day. And if people right. don't want to comply with her advice and her guidance and the things that she puts out and makes accessible for them, there's not really much at that point that she's able to kind of do to enforce that, I don't think.
So when you founded this group and you think about, okay, what's the long-term goal? What's the one thing that you've been working on that you want to get done, or something you want to come out of this working group? Like, what's one thing you want accomplished?
I think there's a couple of things. I'm not sure I can narrow it to one. I'd have to think about that. But
Give me all of them, Patrick. I don't care.
But I think, well, I'm not sure I'd give you all of them either, but I'll let you have a few of the key ones anyway. I think one of the important things is the importance of the dialogue and kind of being able to kind of learn from other people. I came very much into this from the travel security part of travel risk. So I came into it looking at it very much from a security lens. But of course, there's a variety of other things out there that can still present an issue or a concern for travelers besides something that's a pure incident involving security. So, and health is probably the issue that stands out the highest amount, health and things involving medical, because a lot of places in the world, particularly the more austere areas, there are issues in those areas with receiving treatment. And if something bad happens, understanding what your options are and so forth. And I think by talking to other people and other organizations, we're able to expand our own knowledge base and in the same time improve the overall safety and security of our personnel who are traveling. And I think it becomes a situation where, you know, I don't have all the answers. I've been at this for over 20 years, but I don't have all the answers. I'm still very open to kind of hearing how other people manage their programs and individual situations and incidents and so forth. And for example, things on communications. I mean, I've learned a lot of what some of the different options are for comms in crisis situations from talking to people at international aid organizations and oftentimes underfunded organizations where they have to make do with off the shelf things. So I think the information exchange is a kind of critical part of it. I don't think it's as much a case of having a tangible product at the end. I think it's more a path of development for the people who are in the group as individuals and therefore consequently for their organizations to kind of build stronger programs and have a greater ability, particularly now with all the things which are happening in the world. I mean, there always have been issues involved with travel risk, but I mean, if you look at the geopolitical environment nowadays, you see that there's an impact on business operations and travel.
Let's dive into that, shall we? Sure. First of all, real quick, can anyone join that working group if they're ASIS members?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely.
There you go. Okay. So geopolitical climate right now. You're not joking with travel risk now being front and center, right? So tell me how that complicates your job, anyone's job, when dealing with travel risk with everything going on.
Yeah, I think it complicates it on two big fronts. The first one is the practical front. So sending a traveler or being concerned about a traveler being in an area where something is happening that's concerning or where the situation could potentially change. Again, I think October 6th in Italy, in Israel, a lot of people felt fairly comfortable and didn't have a lot of concerns. By October 7th, they were scrambling to evacuate personnel out of the country. So understanding that, and that opens up a whole other issue about tripwires and things of that nature. But I think understanding that you can have somebody in a place that you think is comparatively calm and benign, and something bad can happen very suddenly and change that, I think we're seeing that. And I think that's something you have to manage on the practical side. I think, you know, as I said earlier, I think, you know, the security function and travel risk should be an enabler for operations inside an organization. We shouldn't be the ones who say, you can't go, you can't do this, you can't do that. But I think being able to consider what things and provide advice, because most of the time it's not going to be us who make the final decision, but to provide advice and counsel on the implications of traveling to certain places and how can that risk be mitigated, and what types of potential things do we need to consider in terms of scenarios. So I think all those things are things on the practical side of managing it. And I think the other side is perception of employees within the organization and other travelers. You know, you may have consultants or other types of outsourced personnel that you're involved with. And being able to manage the perceptions, particularly now with the kind of 24/7 cycle we get on the news, and the fact that, you know, you individuals, I think, are bombarded with information in a way that they were not even 10, 15 years ago. So I think there's so much information out there. So many people are coming to their own conclusions about what something means or what the implications are. And so many people are taking information from sources that may be biased or maybe wrong. So being able to manage that perception to be able to help the traveler or the employee understand or put their situation in perspective. So if I'm somewhere in the Middle East right now, that's unaffected with the current situation, I might be very concerned if I'm a traveler because I'm seeing this constantly in the news. Well, how soon is it going to impact me here? And I think being able to kind of frame that and help them understand things that are a concern, things which are not a concern, the whole perception aspect is extremely important as well.
You've hit on so many things that I want to talk about. So the first one is obviously from a crisis comm standpoint and from a public relations standpoint, right? You're always preparing for the worst case scenario, even if it doesn't happen, right? That's part mm-hmm. of that's the whole premise of risk mitigation. So when you talk about, you know, especially with geopolitical events and some of these things, Israel's a great example. I don't think anyone expected that. And we were that's why the whole world was kind of shocked that Israel got caught by surprise, right? So in the realm of PR and planning, I always like to say, you know, a helicopter pilot doesn't take off without a plan if something goes wrong, right, to avoid the crash. And that's kind of how I look at everything, right, in my life, even not just from a work standpoint. And perception, yeah, I mean, helping, I think you hit on such a good point that not enough security professionals, I mean, I don't think I've ever talked about this on the podcast, that it's not just our job to come up with an operations plan, but it's kind of our job to give expert advice on what is a real threat and what is a perceived threat. I think that's a great, great topic, because if they're getting their news from TikTok and not from a reputable source, then they might have a skewed view and it might skew their want or need for security or lack thereof, or want to travel, or ignoring the signs. So I think that's a great point. I mean, how often do you encounter that where you have to adjust the perception and give a more realistic dose of the geopolitical climate?
I think it's almost constant. I think it works both up and down. I think it's important when you're advising up the chain of command to make sure that the perspective is understood, because a lot of times you'll have people in an organization who are receiving a lot of their information from public sources, and the exact same things the employees are looking at, right? And then I think working with individual travelers, particularly if they're concerned about a trip, or particularly if they have some anxiety, being able to help them understand that and frame that. And, you know, even within an organization of 80,000, as I had in that other example, I mean, being able to have a method where you people can seek out a consultative opportunity with somebody who can talk to them about your trip. Here's some of the things you need to consider. Here are some of the cultural things, which is a whole other issue that you have to think about when you're traveling in a certain place, and help them be concerned about the things that are more of a concern and not as concerned about some of the things that they have perceptions about, maybe.
Well, I think that's just a great point. What are some of your, you know, in your own role and in the working group, like what are some of the major concerns right now, like that you have, that you talk regularly about?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, we talk a lot about hotels, has been surfacing a lot. I think there's a lot of misconception generally about hotels and the degree of safety and security. Excuse me one second, I have a barking dog here. One.
I love those life happens moments.
Apologies for that. Yeah. No, we've been oriented a lot in hotels. You probably heard about the issue where there's somebody was able to compromise a type of hotel lock. So basically they could open up 3 million hotel doors around the world, something like that, which is concerning. But I think, you know, one of the things we talked about is kind of framing that against all the other concerns within hotels as well, too. Understanding that hotels are sometimes are not the safe place you think they are, right? And oftentimes are a magnet for people who have ill intentions, because you have a bunch of travelers there who are most of the time not familiar with the area, aren't necessarily individuals who have resources in that area and so forth. So, you know, that's one of the areas we've covered. We've covered a lot around comms, around the implications of geopolitics, all the things we're talking about now, actually. And as I said, it's interesting to kind of see how people handle things at their organization and how those approaches can be kind of different depending on who they work for and the country that they're in and so forth. I mean,
and
I
budget
was
probably as well.
Sorry?
And budget.
Oh yeah. Well, that's always a factor and always something that you have to think about and consider. But I think, you know, for me as an American, a lot of times I didn't think about you have people in other countries overseas who do assessments before they're sent travelers to Miami or Chicago or somewhere like that. Right.
Yeah.
And for us, you know, a lot of times we hop on the plane, and just go. But that is one thing that's helpful to kind of understand from perspective, is that things for us that are quite normal are not for individuals, you know, overseas. And it's the opposite as well. Right. I mean, we have concerns about areas that we're not as familiar with, or there are threats we don't encounter regularly and so on. So I think one of the advantages of the group has been just kind of exchanging ideas on topics of that type.
You know, we run everything, you know, Intel is our gateway to all, right? Like you're only as good as the information you have and verify. So, you know, when you deal with this, how important, you know, is it to take the time and do your due diligence with collecting intel? If you can't, maybe you don't have the budget to go and do an advance, right? So how important is that level of intelligence before you head over?
I think it's extremely important. I have like a kind of model I work off that's like a more of a functional model, and the kind of three pillars of it. The first one is intel. The second one are your procedures to go mitigate risk. And the third one is your procedures for response if an incident happens. And I think the intel piece is super important. And I think there's a lot with the intel to look at. To begin with, I think the intel has to be oriented as much as possible when you're looking at the area where travelers are going to be as granular as you can. So I think it's helpful to start with information about the country. And you can get the travel, you know, information from State Department or other entities of that type, OSAC, or from private sector sources. But I think a lot of times you can start with that, but you want to try and drill down as much as you can to the areas the traveler will be in within a particular city, which sometimes is not that easy. But there are a fair amount of resources out there for free. So even if you can't afford a subscription provider, there are things that you're able to kind of tap into, which will help. It can take you a little bit more time and things of that nature. One of the other things too, that I think is super important with the intel is to have multiple sources. You don't ever want to accept a single source for anything, right? So if you have an intel provider that you hire, or if you have a travel assistance company that provides that as part of the service, you don't want to open up the thing. Well, I'm going over to Burundi. Let me see what's going on in Burundi. Open up one thing. Oh, okay. And have that be the end of it. You want to always have multiple sources, and you always want to account for any type of biases as well, too. I talk to a lot of people who say, well, I talked to our country manager, or I talked to somebody there, and they said this. So it's obviously all correct because the person's there. And I'm all in favor of hitting all the resources you can and speaking to people on the ground 100%, absolutely. But you need to understand, particularly when you're talking to people in that environment, their perspective is not necessarily the same, right? So if I'm somebody who grew up in a country where it's common to have high crime and civil unrest, for me, something that would be a traumatic incident for you is like, you know, every other Tuesday for me, right? I mean, it's completely right. Normal. So if you ask me, hey, how are things? Oh, things are great. You know, and outside, you know, there's stuff happening in the street behind me or whatever. So yeah. I think understanding that and understanding that people may have a commercial interest in mind as well. So if you have a partner in some country and you're talking to them, oh, how are things there? And the partner's thinking, well, if I tell him how bad things are, he won't want to come here, or the organization will not want to invest here. So I'll tell him things are great. Or if you're talking to a security company in that country, oh, things are very bad, sir. You know, you need to have a lot of security here. So all that is fine. And I think it's worth talking to all those people or all those examples, but you just have to consider the perspective, any kind of biases, and filter that in. And ideally, if you can hit a bunch of different sources, then you want to look at how that information goes and compares. Is it mostly consistent? Are there inconsistencies? And then understanding if there are inconsistencies, is that something that's going to impact the traveler? Because the other areas I think that are important to kind of tie into the intel piece is the profile of the traveler himself or herself, and the activity that they're involved in. So if you have a traveler who has a certain profile, there may be increased concerns traveling to certain areas. And those can include the things we normally think about, which can be gender, race, ethnicity, LGBTQ, all these other factors, but it can be other things too. It can be age. You know, if you have an older traveler and you're sending them to an austere place and they have a higher incidence or higher chance of having some kind of an issue because of their health, or individuals who are on prescription meds, as an example. And this is one of the overlooked areas that I think is a pitfall for some travelers, is that a lot of countries throughout the world have restrictions on the type of meds that you can carry in there, even in a prescription bottle. So you may have a traveler who's on three or four separate types of pills. You should know beforehand, or the traveler should at least be advised beforehand that they need to investigate. Do I have any concerns traveling to country X with these prescriptions? And if there is, are there ways I can get them cleared in advance? So, and obviously a lot of that stuff you get into an HR area where it gets somewhat tricky, but you want to make sure that you at least are highlighting that issues exist. And if you think that you could fall into this basket, you know, speak with us and we'll help you with any information we have. And then the other part of that is the activity the traveler will be involved in. So the profile can be, even for an area that's higher risk, the profile can be a lot different if you are going to a country or your travelers or a city, and you're going to be staying at one hotel and you're going to an event a block away from the hotel, coming back to the hotel, the airport, and home, as opposed to you're helping underprivileged people in a poor area of town as part of a charity project or international aid. So all these things are things that have to be kind of calculated, I think, when you're evaluating it.
You know, and talking about threats, I'm sitting here wondering, you know, with so much intelligence being illegally shared and stolen. Mm-hmm. You know, how big of a concern is it that when you send out a travel agenda or an EA does, that you have to worry about that information being compromised at some point?
Yeah, I think what what I see more, or what I get concerned about more, is travelers oversharing information when they are traveling with people who don't really have any kind of need at all to know. One thing that I often caution individuals on, which is something that I don't see covered a lot, is when you get approached when you're traveling by somebody you don't know. So you're in a hotel or you're in an airport or something, you get approached by somebody you don't know and they seem like they're friendly or they have some kind of a pretext for wanting to speak to you. Start asking you questions, start wanting to befriend you. And sometimes in some of those instances, it's completely innocent, right? But a lot of times there's some other agenda at play. You know, it may be a scam, it may be to set you up for some other type of crime, but there's something else usually happening when that occurs. So, yeah. And I think it's the same kind of thing. I think, you know, you shouldn't be sharing information about your travel with anyone who doesn't have to have it. And, you know, if you're in some place where you have contracted drivers, I generally advise you give the information to a driver, you know, the smallest amount of time ahead of time that they would need to respond or react. I don't think you have to hand a driver an itinerary for 5 days when you show up. Because I think, you know, you don't necessarily know who that individual is or who they're talking to. And it may be something where even if that individual is completely harmless, if they go home and they're talking to people in their household or in their neighborhood and it comes up in conversation, it can be a potential vulnerability. So, and I know there's some people think that's over the top, but I think in general, if you're traveling, particularly solo travelers, you want to probably share the smallest amount of information possible.
Makes sense. You know, I tell my friends, stop checking in. Stop sharing your location when you're out of town. Just on a very local, you don't need security, average Joe level.
No, I think that's a great example, though. I think that's an excellent example.
Well, I always like to ask like a personal story, and I know I put everyone on the spot. Is there an incident throughout your career, either military or corporate, or something that really kind of shaped your purpose or drove you to do what you're doing or impacted you in a way that kind of changed you on some level?
Yeah, it's interesting you say this because I told this actually on a podcast a while ago. I don't think it's aired yet. Yeah, I actually wouldn't have thought about this. It kind of came up when somebody else asked me, but I'll tell you the same story. You know, I grew up in a fairly modest family. I didn't have a lot of international travel as a kid, or travel period, really. But as a when I was in high school, we had a high school trip to Mexico. And this was in the early to kind of mid 80s. So, you know, I'll let you have an idea how old I am, but early to mid 80s. And we were traveling to Mexico City and to the Pacific coast around Ixtapa. And when we were in the Ixtapa area, and this is a group of, there were probably 15 to 20 of us maybe, and a couple of chaperones. We were staying in a hotel outside Ixtapa and we decided to travel into Ixtapa for the evening, you know, to eat out or whatever else. Yeah. I don't recall exactly. And the taxis in Mexico at the time, and I think until fairly recently, a lot of them were like the small type of old style VW Bugs. And so it could only sit like probably three people in the driver.
Sure.
And so we had to split up a bunch of, over a bunch of different taxis. And two of our chaperones were in one taxi, or what they believed was a taxi, I don't know if it was or not, but we all went to the left and they ended up going to the right. And essentially what was happening was it was some kind of a attempted kidnapping situation. So we all arrive in Ixtapa. We don't see them. And of course, this is before people have cell phones and all this other kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but
we
obviously understood that we had a problem of some kind. And to make a kind of long story short, or as short as I can anyway, they both ultimately escaped out of the taxi and somehow made it back and found us. But in the interim, we were going to the police stations and trying to get help at the police station and things like that. And it was not... The police and the authorities were not helpful at all.
Right.
And from that, I think I kind of learned a lot about the about some of the fragile aspect of traveling overseas. And I mean, I won't say that was like the catalyst that launched me into a career in security or anything like that. But I think it was something that was impactful because I think it helped me understand at an early age that, you know, particularly when you travel overseas, a lot of the kind of rules are different, and a lot of the expectations you might have and the kind of support that you might have other places is not the same. And I think that's an important thing for all of us to articulate with our travelers, particularly our newer travelers, to understand that when you're in a foreign country, you have to follow foreign laws. You know, you don't say, I'm an American citizen, I don't have to follow this. You have to follow it, even if you don't agree with it, or you find it, you know, ethically problematic. If that's what it is, you don't really have a choice if you're in their country. Yeah. And the other thing is understanding that, you know, in the United States, we have a lot of kind of services to help us. We have a lot of, you know, police and fire and emergency services and hospitals and things like that. And there are a lot of things, if you have a problem, that you can kind of fall back on. But a lot of places overseas, that's, you know, it is not the case. And a lot of places, the police are not your friend. And sometimes involving them in situations can make it worse, depending on the country. And in a lot of areas of the world, if you have a car accident or something, you get injured, it can be a serious problem because the infrastructure is not as it is here in the United States or some of the other areas of the world we're familiar with. So I think having travelers understand that and have that expectation is an important aspect. I think that's one of the things I kind of found out at an early age.
Well, thanks for sharing that story. And absolutely, right? Like, traveling gives us perspective and knowledge is power. So do your homework. As you like to say, go to multiple sources, which I always said as a news person, everyone would say, where do I get a non-biased story? And I'm like, well, it's like the game of telephone. So you kind of have to watch three different news outlets and kind of grain of salt it, right, to get the full story if you're not going to get the verbatim transcript from whatever event you're looking to get the over-under on. So, Patrick, tell me what I've missed. Tell me what you would tell someone thinking about going into corporate security, either from they're looking at this as a college kid, they're looking at this as post-military, post-law enforcement. What would you say about a life in corporate security?
Well, I'd say it's a great opportunity because I'd say there are so many areas of specialization that you can pursue. I think, again, if you flash back 20 or 30 years, the industry was a lot different. I think it was smaller, and I don't think the opportunities existed as much. But I think it has a lot of opportunity now. So I think within that umbrella, you know, you could be an Intel analyst. You could be a manager for a facility and manage a security forces there. You can do things involving technology, camera systems, alarm systems. You can be involved in investigations and uncovering fraud. You can do this stuff we're talking about now involving travel risk. You can do executive protection. There's a variety of separate areas for kind of specialization. So I think in that regard, it's one of those things where you're not going to ever be able to kind of explore everything. So it's always, I guess, interesting, or there's always other things out there, other challenges. And I think increasingly now we're seeing more of a convergence, or at least a collaboration, in the cyberspace as well, too. So I think there's a greater need now for individuals who possess skills both in the physical end of security, but also in the cyber end as well, because I think that those are quickly becoming closer and closer every day.
I think that's a sweet spot if you're looking for a future in security, right? You have that physical history, and then now you go get educated and you learn how to do some of these cyber tasks. I mean, I think that's a sweet spot. I think you're onto something there. And also, you know, I'll wrap this by saying, like, I just appreciate that, you know, people like you that have huge jobs actually take the time to give back to these industry organizations, because that is so important to be involved and to help people coming up and coming in that need knowledge that they wouldn't otherwise be able to tap into if it weren't for these organizations. So just highlighting the importance of groups like ASIS or SVSG, or, you know, whatever groups you want to point to, right? I just appreciate all the industry organizations for taking the time to help folks. I know it was helpful for me coming into a new industry. So thank you for that. And thank you for your time, Patrick.
Absolutely. It was great.
Yeah. So I appreciate you and appreciate all of you for listening and watching. And if you would like more episodes of Time to Head North, you can find them on our website, tngdefense.com, or you can listen on Spotify, Podbean, or iTunes. Until next time, have a great day, everyone. Thank you.